Welcome back to the second portion of today's 6th CEU seminar regarding transforming trauma. We began today's seminar by highlighting the importance of defining trauma according to what the clients make of their presenting concern and whether or not they consider it to be trauma. Trauma, as I highlighted, is not about the actual action and whether or not it constitutes trauma, but more about the client perception of anxiety, of fight, flight, or freeze, of threat to self or others. Now, the second part, I just wanted to go over possible medication agents that might be supplements to therapy. Now, keep in mind that our scope of practice, and mine specifically as an LPCC, is not to give advice regarding medication. So we cannot basically tell a client or recommend to someone they should have any of these certain types of medications. But just to make you aware of what types of things that psychiatrists or medical doctors out there might use in terms of addressing some of the co-occurring types of mental health issues. The first category of medications that are oftentimes used is what's called the SSRIs. These are the types of things that are in the category of Celexa, Lexapro, Prozac, Luvox, Paxil, or Zoloft. These tend to address the depression or the anxiety sort of symptoms that may co-occur with trauma. There are also other serotoninergic agents that may be used. Things like Effexor, XR, Cymbalta, Strattera, Wellbutrin, Remeron, Desiril, or Surzone. What I generally do when I think there might be a client who is not already on medication, who may benefit from a medication evaluation, is to actually get a release of consent signed and then to give a brief summary based on that release of consent about this mutual client of ours, some of the symptoms and the diagnosis and treatment recommendations, and then have some kind of collateral discussion with the primary care or, if possible, a psychiatrist. There are also adrenergic agents, including Enderol, Catapress, and Minipress, that sometimes are used. The tricyclic antidepressants include things like Elavil, Anafrinil, Norpramazine, Tofranil, and Pamelor. And then we have mood stabilizers. Sometimes our clients aren't just dealing with depression or mania, but are dealing with something like a bipolar or a psychothymic type of issue. To that end, if it's possible that the diagnosis is bipolar, a psychiatrist or medical doctor may want to prescribe a mood stabilizer. Those would include things like lithium or lithobid, lamotrigine or lamictal, Depakote, Tegradol, Topinax, Neurontin, Keppra, or Gabatril. We also have things like benzodiazepines, which tend to be really minimally prescribed because of the highly addictive nature. These would be things that would be fast-acting types of medications that would relate for people that are having heightened anxiety, more of the panic type of mode. These are things including Xanax, Klonopin, Valium, Ativan, Restoril, Halcyon, or Serotex. Again, these are things that are oftentimes very cautiously prescribed. Now, some people may also be prescribed something like an atypical antipsychotic. We do have clients sometimes that, in addition to mood types of symptoms, may benefit from an atypical antipsychotic. Things like Risperidol, Zyprexa, Seroquel, Geodon, Abilify, Clozaril, Safris, Latuda, or Phanapt. So I just wanted to make sure that, again, that you had a listing of those type of medications and the possible doses that they generally try to give. I think a lot of times, as mental health professionals, as counselors or social workers, a lot of times we're not aware of what the medications are or the various names. So it's beneficial sometimes to know what is out there. So if you see those names, or if you're doing the diagnostic assessment and a client's telling you, oh yeah, I'm on this, or my doctor is thinking about such and such, it helps us to know what's out there. Now, one of the things I wanted to look at as we continue to look at the impact of trauma is, for many people, there's this core issue of shame. The way I define shame is it's a type of internalized suffering. Basically, we can differentiate between regrets we have over behaviors we wish we would have done a certain way versus things that are part of our personhood. However, the person that's struggling with shame, they tend to be self-critical, they tend to be judgmental, or perceive things as judgmental by other people. They tend to believe that the self deserves to actually be punished for some perceived wrong. Sometimes they're struggling with making that differentiation between this is what I've done and I can change or make a plan for an alternative behavior versus this is who I am. One of the ways I phrase this when I counsel people is that oftentimes those who have shame at the core tend to pick up with the unpleasant or negative self-messages where the abuser left off. And so I will have a tendency over time, as I hear their narrative, to make an empathic statement about the fact of, you know, not picking up where the abuser left off. There's a sense of justice for wrongs done or for past or broken values. It's basically as if with shame someone has a broken compass for trust and acceptance. They're really guarded. They have an internal sense that they, as opposed to their actions, are deficient and flawed. So there's five core components in the literature that talk about what constitutes shame. Oftentimes when people come to us with shame, they have low self-esteem. They may have had a history of feeling humiliated, or may themselves feel embarrassed or humiliated, even if others don't feel that. They have problems with self-continuity. So we see a difficulty about identifying who they are in their core identity. They have a sense that they're isolated or they don't fit in. So even if the evidence is to the contrary, they tend to just feel that they're on the outside. They also feel like they're being watched by others, and with that perception, to judge or to criticize. Sometimes the shame just hurts so much that people build up defenses against the shame over time. Some of those include blaming others. Sometimes when someone's really defensive, or you hear a client talking excessively when they come in for their presenting concerns about someone else who did them wrong, it may be a defense against shame. Some people tend to play the chronic victim role. There may be things like gaslighting, or you may see other clients who might have an excessive focus on perfectionism. They have to be, quote, good, right, strong, and perfect. With this, I have a tendency when I'm doing treatment and offering recommendations to them to add the phrase, in whose opinion? Because it's hard when someone's trying to, quote, keep everybody happy, to jump through all these hoops, look at all the imaginary rules by different people to be good, right, strong, and perfect. So I'll encourage clients to ask, in whose opinion? According to whom? And at what price? If I continue to jump through all these hoops, where might I be a month from now, or 6 months from now, or years from now? Other people defend against shame by trying to minimize issues so they just don't have to change or look at them. Some people go the route of narcissism. You might see something as ego and pride that really might be insecurity deep down. Sometimes when clients come to us and there's issues like anger or rage or hate, there may be some shame core issues. We also find shame is a issue involved with codependency. And other defenses that might be used might be avoidance or addiction. At the core of shame, there are messages of not being enough. There are messages of attacking personhood. Things like, you'll never be such and such, or you'll only be such and such. You should be ashamed of yourself. Don't think or feel. Don't have opinions. Don't have beliefs on things. Don't rock the boat. Just be good, right, strong, and perfect. Don't be who you are, because who you are isn't acceptable or worthwhile. Walk on eggshells. Try and put everybody else's needs first. You're not allowed to be yourself. You have to adapt to others. You should be more of such and such or less of such and such. And you can see where someone thought that for quite a while over time, that they would just feel like giving up. They would just feel like, oh great, I can never measure up. One of the exercises that I give clients for homework that has proved pretty beneficial for many of them is to write a letter to guilt or shame. Basically, in doing that, I encourage them to kind of personify as if shame was a person, as if it was that critical voice. And for some people that are artistic, they might want to draw out a picture of what the character of shame would look like. That voice that tries to suck the life out of them. That voice that tries to tell them that they're not and how they failed and fallen short. So in that letter, they might want to talk about that there may be some initial useful functions in terms of thinking of behaviors that they could have done different, but this can also be toxic. So they're basically reevaluating, if shame was a person, would I really want this person in my life? And to what degree or what extent would I want them involved? What role do I really want them to have from here on? The literature talks about something called assumptive world theory. The idea being that initially we come into life as a young innocent child with the idea that the world's good. It's a happy place. We can trust people. It's secure. Things are going to turn out right. So a very positive and innocent type of point of view. But over time, for the person who's faced something that they're perceiving as trauma, this assumptive world theory just gets blown out of the water. That person's no longer feeling like the world's safe and secure. Instead, they may be feeling things like that they're broken, that they have nothing to offer anyone anymore, or that they're helpless to avoid bad situations. They might feel like all people are bad out there, or that they have this sense of perpetual distrust or cynicism of people. They might think that anything that remotely links to any part of their memories of the trauma needs to be avoided, that the future is hopeless and things are just not able to be controlled no matter what. So towards this end, a lot of times they replay over those triggers and triggers and triggers. So there's several sorts of stories they tend to tell themselves to replay over, thinking, oh, if I think over these triggers, maybe I can, in theory, control things. For example, I've known some people that maybe they never felt they could control the abuse or the trauma or the stress around them, but they tried to control with food and ended up with an eating disorder. Maybe certain objects like sticks, rods, hangers, or objects used to beat them or threaten them became memories for them. Maybe locked doors are a reminder of beating, abuse, or secrets in general. Now, there was one case, for example, where someone hated when it was the cold weather or the time of the years, that was really a trigger for that person. And at first, the therapist had a hard time understanding why. But basically what it was is that cold weather represented an inescapable time from getting away from an alcoholic family member. So things that might not seem to add up to us oftentimes have symbolic meaning when we take the time. And again, it does take time to unfold that narrative. We really want to go at the client's pace. And I even say that directly to a client, you know, that while I know you want to get out of this uncomfortable place and want to move on to better things and less pain, that we really want to take therapy at your pace and what's comfortable for you. So what are some alternatives and different ways of thinking then if someone's gone through trauma and just reevaluating? So maybe a different way of believing is helping them see that I have gone through some things that would cause anyone to have to re-examine what they think about life. Or, I am one person. It's not realistic for me to perfectly juggle all these events and memories in a way that they will not affect me. Another alternative could be the thought of, I've dealt with some changes before in life. Maybe not this exact thing, but there may be some skills I could modify and use to approach what I'm going through now. I really like this last one, and I've used it a lot with my recent clients, about the idea of, especially if we're talking like a middle-aged adult, I'll ask them, what have you managed? Which is a very strengths-based, solution-focused approach. What have you done to this point that maybe you don't feel like a survivor in this situation? But you have faced other changes and other things. How did you manage those? And it plants a seed in the client's mind that, ah, there's something I've done that was empowering. There's something where I exercised a choice. So maybe I could again. With the narrative therapy, another type of alternative thought is that all the chapters of my life are not yet written. Yeah, I've had some unpleasant and deeply painful things happen to me, but those chapters or events of my life don't determine who I am. Things don't have to be good or bad. They can just be. I've ridden the waves of these emotions, such as anxiety, depression, and stress before, and I've learned that eventually the wave survives. This idea of a wave is a really interesting and helpful metaphor for many of our clients. What I'll tell them is that the goal isn't necessarily saying they'll never feel anxious or never think ahead about possibilities or unpleasant things happening, but that in spite of that, they'll be able to put it in context. And the final alternative way of thinking could be things that are awful, even them. They're not permanent. They don't have to be permanent. Life does change, and things can even possibly change for the better. This is a very resiliency-focused mindset. The keys that the literature highlights over and over is the importance of giving a voice to shame. Without allowing a client to share his or her narrative with our support, and at a reasonable pace that he or she can feel comfortable, it's really hard to move beyond shame. We can use art and metaphor to work through narratives. Sometimes the directness of just talking about a narrative can be really overwhelming for a client, so that metaphor can be useful. And one of the other things we can do is help a client learn to express his or her needs. The fact of the matter, and this is a totally different way for a traumatized person to think, is that even their symptoms, even the unpleasant ones, helped them survive. The hopelessness, while it doesn't feel like it's helpful, actually aided them in freezing. Kind of like our thought-stopping techniques that we try to keep clients. The insomnia, while that doesn't feel pleasant, helps them, in theory, be ready for what their mind's thinking about. The decreased concentration helps them, again, in theory, to be able to conserve their energy to focus on the things they need to. So even things like depression or anxiety, hypervigilance, body aches, dissociation are in their own way protective. They're survival related, not event related. There's a lot of biology that you can read about in terms of the literature about how the brain reacts to perceived trauma. And the brain has a negativity bias. Basically, the brain's sort of telling the body, be ready, do something. Don't move yet until it's safe. There is an excellent book, if you want to read more about the biology of things, that talks about the body keeps score. Safe people, again, often are the ones that pay the price. They're the ones in the traumatized person's life that might be pushed away. They might have a sense of trying to evaluate what's real. They might be on the receiving end of the client testing out the environment or restoring. One of the things that we hear a lot about is codependency. And a lot of times there's a population of clients that end up codependent as a result of wrestling through some of these abuse and trauma issues as well. Codependency essentially is defined as someone feeling safer when giving love, being a rescuer, a confidant, or support. Someone who sometimes tries to obtain love from difficult others or depending on someone who's not dependable. There's four areas, four core elements to codependency. The first is external focus. They tend to be focused on what everyone else around them is doing. They tend to be self-sacrificing. Again, initially that works because they're giving, they're believing, they're helping others. Whereas over time, that only builds up to more resentment. The third of the four core elements of codependency is interpersonal control. This idea that if I can possibly control things, then maybe I am able to start to trust again or protect myself against certain things that I don't want to happen. And the final element of codependency is emotional suppression. The idea being, I want to prevent myself against hurt at all costs. Why would someone choose this? Well, again, they're wanting to prevent painful thoughts and feelings. They want to avoid emotional conflict, avoid perceived threats, or cope with abuse. The idea is, again, don't think, don't feel, don't share directly. Be good, right, strong, and perfect. Again, like I said before, according to whom? Don't be who everyone else wants. Don't be who you want to be. Be who everyone else wants you to be. Lose yourself. We hear in the literature about codependency a concept called limerence. Basically, people who are codependent tend to bend to everyone else's needs and relationships. They tend to constantly want to do what's going to keep the relationship from falling apart. As a result, they may have anxiety, fears of abandonment, and may never know genuine intimacy. So they may just have false intimacy. They may start with people pleasing, thinking in theory that if they can identify what others want, they can keep them happy. Now, this works initially for a while, but then over time, it falls apart because the resentment and anger just builds to where that codependent person becomes bitter. They're tired. They're fatigued. Melody Beatty is someone who speaks a lot about the whole idea of codependency. In her book, Codependent No More, she has a quote here that I think really is a good summary of what describes codependency. I stopped living my own life. I stopped feeling. I was left with rage, bitterness, hatred, fear, depression, helplessness, despair, and guilt. At times, I wanted to stop living. I had no energy. I spent most of my time worrying about people and trying to figure out how to control them. I couldn't say no to anything except for fun activities, even if my life depended on it. And it did. My relationships with friends and family were in shambles. I felt terribly victimized. I lost myself and didn't know even what happened to get to this point. I thought I was going crazy, and I thought shaking a finger at people around me, it's their fault. Sadly, aside from myself, no one knew how badly I felt. So there's this preoccupation with fear of rejection, but also at the same time, a deep longing for connection. And sometimes a connection at all costs may not be healthy. There's a sense of not being able to handle any doubts or instability or an obsession with other parts of the other or denial of some parts of the other. Sex seals this pattern. And with codependency, a lot of the patterns mimic obsessive compulsive disorder or drug highs. So let's look at how someone might assess for codependency. This is something we might see with some of our clients with trauma. There's some questions I might go over or discuss these concepts with a client. Do you keep quiet to avoid arguments? Are you always worried about others' opinions of you? Have you lived with someone with a drug or alcohol problem? Have you lived with someone who belittles you? Are there opinions of others that are more important than yours? Do you have difficulty adjusting to changes at work or home? Do you feel rejected when significant others spend time with friends? Do you doubt your ability to be who you want to be? Are you uncomfortable expressing your true feelings to others? Have you ever felt inadequate? Some other things that we might want to assess for as well are things like, do you feel like you're a bad person when you make a mistake? And that targets the whole aspect again of shame, which is such a core to anything that's linked to trauma. Do you have difficulty taking compliments or gifts from someone? Do you feel humiliation when your spouse or child makes a mistake? So with this one, it's getting at the core belief of people are just a reflection of me. Do you feel like people in your life would go downhill without your effort? Do you frequently feel like someone else should help you get things done? Do you have difficulty talking to people in authority? Are you confused about who you are or what you're doing with your life? This goes back to that identity. Without a secure foundation of secure attachments and with constantly compromising with that limerence and bending to everyone else's will, there's a sense of not knowing who they are. Do you have trouble asking for help or for your needs? Are you hard on yourself, allowing others mercy and justice, but then being very self-critical? So the solution, according to a 2019 article by Norman, Allard, Brown, Capone, Davis, and Bacuffini, is to determine how to love someone, to love themselves authentically. Now, this sounds a lot easier than actually doing it. And this may take a great deal of time in therapy. So the first step would be having awareness of feelings, thoughts, and behaviors. Then allowing oneself untethered freedom to explore life circumstances. So going back to those kind of missed or those awry developmental experiences, like as a child, those things where the awe and wonder and sense of being able to be who they are didn't happen the way it should have. Another way of determining to love oneself authentically is to be truthful about the reality of what actions happened, even when they might be hurtful, and look at, okay, what did I want to happen versus what happened? Then to have a realistic, balanced sense of optimism and resilience. We can also help a client look at what their values, what their desires and their core beliefs are, and make sure that their actions are in line with the things that are meaningful to them, that they're not compromising those, that they're learning to have mercy towards themselves as a survivor, as someone who's gone through things, and someone who can take a proactive interest in their own destiny and their goals and what they want the next parts of the narratives to be. We can help them be introspective and self-evaluate and have that curiosity to ask questions that they might have feared. Now, one of the types of therapy that we all know is highlighted as efficacious in the literature is cognitive behavioral treatment. To this end, we can help the client manage his or her anxiety. We can do a sort of Socratic debating types of things, like helping them ask, is what I'm thinking a fact or just a strong opinion? What evidence do I have that it will come true? Is there any other way of thinking about it? What is the worst thing that could happen if it came true? And what is most likely to happen? I have a tendency with my clients to focus on the fact that if you're assuming the worst is going to happen, that at least there's minimally an equal, if not higher, likelihood that something more neutral or even positive could happen. So what we're essentially doing with a client is we're helping them to reprocess their narrative with the added perspective of the present. So one way we can approach and empower the traumatized person is that, well, of course you felt A, B, and C. When you were a child or when you were in the midst of this trapped situation where you feel like you didn't have options, you didn't have these resources that you do in the present. But now we do have resources. We do have strengths. And one of the biggest things that my clients say has been most helpful for them is me reminding them that you have choices and you have options right now. Maybe they didn't in that situation, or it would be hard to see or exercise them, but to realize that there are choices now, to help them identify what those are, and to also help them through small, rational, realistic goals to look at how they can implement those choices. Part of this also involves that shame reduction and looking at, given the context of what was going on at the time of the trauma, was there anything else you really could have done? It can help them to see that in the moment when they were going through that traumatic situation, that shame was actually protective. That trauma, in some ways, as awful as it felt and unpleasant, was protective. We can also ask questions like, how has personalizing or blaming yourself really even helped? Did you want this thing to happen to you? And if not, is there any other way of looking at it? One of the biggest concerns that many of our clients have, and something that should definitely be on the treatment plan of just about anybody who's gone through trauma, is teaching self-regulation skills. It feels like a flood when people go through memories, when that hypervigilance, when the reliving occurs. So sometimes the self-regulation skills can be some of the most important things we do with our clients. To that end, we can help them learn to identify, name, and monitor their behaviors and emotions. I've had some clients that were so traumatized that to put a name to what they went through, just like a young child, happy, sad, mad, glad, that was hard enough. I remember the other day I had a gentleman who had a lot of characteristics of avoidant personality, and he had layer after layer of deep losses in his life, from childhood to middle adulthood, and just no time to process. He just kept going, going, going. And when his wife mentioned to him something about his level of avoidance, and we started talking about it, he said he didn't even realize that he had any feelings. And so it's almost like a flood just came in, and he couldn't even put words on it. So initially, we're just helping the client to identify, name, and monitor their behaviors and emotions. We're giving them permission, and sometimes you may have to do this very directly, to allow for vulnerability. We're helping differentiate between unpleasant and pleasant emotions versus good and bad emotions. Keep in mind, a client may be like, oh, this emotion's bad because it feels bad. But we want to make sure they understand that it's not that emotions are bad or good, but it's just pleasant or unpleasant. We're decreasing overall arousal. We're normalizing things in the context. We're evaluating triggers in the environment. We're promoting adaptive strategies. It may take time for them to learn these adaptive strategies. It's not an overnight thing. So, for example, something like thought stopping. I've had to role model for my clients. Stop, Michelle, stop. You can think about this. Pause, freeze. You do have choices and options. Then things like building support systems. That can be a challenge for a lot of our traumatized clients because many of their family members or friends don't understand why they, quote unquote, just don't think different. For many of them, they think it's just a matter of willpower. And that can really increase the shame that we've talked about. We can work with clients about changing their self-talk through some of the CBT types of methods, as well as some physical relaxation. I find that sometimes the physical relaxation, things like progressive muscle relaxation, may be beneficial to do even before we get to some of the cognitive behavioral. Because if the person's feeling physiologically tense in their body, it's hard for them to believe something different. Then finally, cognitive reframing. Sometimes with trauma, there is a sense of anger. Anger usually is a cue to something being blocked. We wanted something to happen in our life, and it turned out far different. So it's not unlikely for people who've been victims of some type of trauma to feel anger. One way they deal with it, and this may not necessarily be effective, but this just may be something they do, is turning it inward, holding inside their feelings. I've had a number of my clients who just say, you know, I'll deal with it. I don't want to burden anyone else. I don't want more complications to deal with. So a lot of times we'll see depression, suicidal thoughts, or physical illnesses. So ways of, quote unquote, dealing with it, but in a very indirect manner. Also, another way we might see traumatized people respond to this anger may be by lashing out. It might be yelling, name calling, or in essence, trying to make others pay back when they see perceived wrongs. So keep in mind, if you're dealing with traumatized clients and it seems like their emotional regulation's off or their response is somewhat in excess of what you think it should be, that a lot of times it's just they didn't have a voice before and now they're almost like overcorrecting. So it's not personal necessarily to you. It's just they're trying to figure out this emotional regulation thing. And their brain's really having to rewire, honestly. Sometimes they may project anger onto an object or another person. Sometimes they could provide even a productive outlet. That could be a more positive alternative. But they might do something like physical exercise, like running or working out. They might do something around the house, like cooking or cleaning. They can also do things like talking about it. Remember I said that when we give that vulnerability and that trauma a voice, that starts to be one of the first steps toward healing it. And then finally, problem solving, considering choices of actions. Like I said, my clients have routinely told me one of the best things that really helped them the most was to remind them, you have options. So how does a client do emotional regulation if they're not used to it? Well, I think there's a lot of strength in some of the mindfulness activities. Sometimes things that may seem almost not so cognitive can be some of the best things for our clients. There's been studies of things like the adult coloring books, and sometimes coloring a picture, designing a mandala or something, you know, some artwork can really help. There's a lot of literature that suggests even things like painting out your feelings with different colors and designs, drawing with chalk, using dolls, stuffed animals, or puppets to act out or compose stories, or journaling can be helpful. Other types of mindfulness or self-soothing activities include singing or music. A lot of times it's easier for clients to talk in terms of metaphor than directly about this trauma. They could do productive activities like cooking, talking to a friend, doing focused breathing, gardening, or spending time with a pet. They could ride a bike. They could play in water. They could cuddle in a blanket. These help ground them. Another thing I find that helps our clients when they're feeling particularly helpless is to have a gratitude journal, to have a place where they're able to constructively and proactively look for things that are positive in life. Because again, when they're in the height of their trauma, it's very natural to feel flooded and overwhelmed by what they see as negative things. So to help them look for what they're thankful for, and even if they choose to, write what we call like gratitude notes. Find people, places, or things that they appreciate and look at how they could cultivate more of those or increase the frequency of that. They could even use photographs. There's a whole portion of therapy that surrounds the use of photographs. Basically, the idea being that we can heal through what we choose to focus our time and energy on. So if there's certain people, certain places, nature, or places that may constitute a good, healthy memory, then maybe having photographs of that. Or things like a music playlist, finding what I would particularly call a happy playlist. I've had to specify that with some clients where they'll say, oh, I play this loud, angry music when things are upset. But a playlist of something that it could be jumpy music, it could be calming music, it could be nature sounds or relaxation. Sometimes just things where they're just being in the here and now. Things like listening to the birds, watching the clouds. Those things can be meaningful, or even just life changes about things that can be empowering to them. Paint your nails, change your hair. I had one lady the other day who said after her husband died that she knew she couldn't leave the house that they grew up in over the years with each other, but that she decided to rearrange the furniture and redecorate some. So looking at what can we focus on? With relaxation, the more specific it is, the better. The more multi-sensory it is, the better. So, for example, if I'm doing a relaxation exercise with a client, I want to make it one where I'm saying, oh, feel the soft breeze. Hear the calm voice. Notice this. So, again, using the different senses, be as descriptive as possible. There's apps out there that also aid in anxiety reduction. Things like Calm, Headspace, Mindful, Slumber, or the Compassion Deck are some of the apps out there that people can use to help with anxiety reduction. Other mindfulness approaches can be things like collages, vision boards, or this one I really liked when I read about it, drawing enough. So you know we use the word enough, E-N-O-U-G-H. There was an article that I found fascinating, and it talked about drawing enough, N-U-F-F. And essentially, enough was a personalized character which represents an end to the abuse, the trauma, the things that the client was saying he or she was done with and wanted to move on, and that was empowering for many of the clients. We also have other types of therapy like emotion-focused trauma therapy. With that, we can communicate with the hypothetical person that it may not in life be possible to communicate with. Of course, we don't want to create an increased trauma episode with a client. We want to make sure that they have the skills they need before they start doing this. So basically an empty chair exercise where we could help the client say what they need and then hear back the types of messages in the session that would be helpful to them. Remember, I talked about the benefits of narrative therapy. So the narrative therapy is very important because it can focus on what's called a restorative narrative. A narrative that shows that in spite of hurt, pain, helplessness, that there is an ongoing story. So when I say restorative narrative, it's important if we're going to employ things like bibliotherapy to make sure that the stories we're encouraging the client to look at involve characters that the client would identify with. If I gave a book or an example for a client to read and they're thinking, oh, but that person has a lot more money than me. Oh, but that person is such and such. I'm not like him or her. Oh, but I can't relate to them. It might not work. We want to find someone they can identify with. So in terms of the narrative processing, there's even individual and group therapies that can be used for processing of horrific abuse, of trauma. For example, in a 2014 article by Foster and Hagedorn, they talked about things that could be done in therapy, things like life before the abuse, what that was like, the first time the abuse occurred, the worst memories, what it's like disclosing the abuse, if there are things like investigating the abuse or trauma, things like the court or other people being involved, how the narrative of one's life has changed over time, counseling experience, and the hopes and dreams. So again, for a narrative to be restorative, it does not get stuck in the hurt and pain of the past, nor does it overly jump to glossing along the hopeful positive of the future. It's comprehensive, but it's at the client's pace. One of the other areas that oftentimes can be very, very helpful for a client is skill building. Sometimes when we're in the middle of something like trauma or traumatic memory, it can be very hard to focus on some of the skills, whether they're things we knew before or things that might need to be developed. One of the areas, for example, that we could help a client with is goal setting. There's an acronym CEA, so the C approach. It talks about helping a client in the moment to focus on S, what is observable, concrete, and behavioral. E, emotions. What feelings do you have in reaction to the situation? And A, aspiration. What are your needs, desires, wants, and goals? I think that's a good comprehensive array of looking at what happened and focusing on the specifics of the experience, how it's affected you and your emotions, and then kind of what next. How and what can be helpful. We can teach clients something like problem-solving steps, helping to name what they see as problems, what are the issues at hand, and even instead of defining them in terms that keep the shame going or keep a sense of helplessness going, helping them to define a problem concretely and behaviorally. Then we can help them use their imagination to brainstorm and look at their choices. First of all, we're just brainstorming choices in a way that we're considering just about anything. Then we're helping them to really imagine the consequences and outcomes based on each possible choice. We create a plan for implementing a choice, but we also assist our clients in checking back about how a choice went. When things go well, it's not just because there's been no flashback or no traumatic memory or nothing activated. It may go well because they decided to exercise a choice or because they basically applied something they learned in therapy. So we need to look at what's gone well and how do we keep it going well. There's another type of problem-solving approach that the literature talks about as being helpful. It looks at the what, why, where, when, how, and who. So in terms of the what, we'd be working with the client about what is my goal? What are the facts? What resources do I need? And what goals might have been suggested. It looks at why. Why is this important to me? Why do I need to solve this problem now? Why do I think the situation did arise? Or why is this suggested? Where did the situation arise? Where is it impacting me? Or where is it impacting others? And then when? When did this arise? When does it need to be addressed? I'm assuming it needs to be addressed now, but is that the case? Or is there another time or way that we could look at it? And do I need to ask for help? When would be the best way to approach people or ask for help? How? How can I get more information? How can the situation change? Again, that's very empowering in looking at resiliency. How would someone else describe the problem? With clients that are traumatized being caught up in that narrative of shame, sometimes it's hard for them to see that someone else might see them as a survivor or as, quote, stronger than they believe themselves to be. And finally, with the problem-solving considerations, they can look at who. Who am I really trying to please? Who really is involved? You know, is it that important to please this other person? Who can I talk with? Who would really give me an objective opinion? Family-based therapies can also be helpful in terms of dealing with trauma. They can help increase overall closeness, flexibility, communication, and problem solving. Remember we talked about with developing secure attachments, the importance of attachment. And a lot of that can be fostered through establishing family routines. So the family can be an excellent setting for reconceptualizing that. You can establish roles of the family members, responsibilities, and boundaries. You can use the family context as a way of offering emotional support. So really, it can be a place to try out some of those emotional regulation and self-soothing skills we talked about. You can also teach skills in resolving value and problem-based conflicts. You can help family members adapt to life changes, increase in positive parenting, and repair and build on relationships. Groups such as family or even a therapy group can be extremely helpful for people with trauma because they help to normalize that they're not alone, that there's other people who have these experiences of the helplessness, that they can learn in a small group setting, even in spite of within group differences, to begin in small vulnerable ways, to develop trust and safety, to define in concrete behavioral ways what that is and practice it. To practice out skills, that skill building and skill development, things like the problem solving we just spoke of, things like conflict resolution and healthy ways of processing of the anger. They can acknowledge feelings and experience. And you can even do exercises when you have these therapy groups within subgroups. Groups are also particularly helpful in terms of working with clients on perspective taking regarding the needs of others and skill development. So when we're looking at shame reduction, there's several things we can look at. I've listed an example of a shame-informed therapy group outline from Ashley in a 2020 article. I think this was phenomenal. This is something I'm definitely going to try and use in some of my client session. So session one would have to do about general group rules and boundaries and education about shame and traumatic reactions and why it's important for shame to be addressed. We'd also want to differentiate with group attendees about the difference between guilt, which is legitimate desire to change unhealthy behaviors, versus shame, which is a personal judgment and self-criticism about our own identity. In the second session, we'd be facilitating group discussion about experiences of guilt and shame. Again, more about differentiating between them and how to self-monitor when guilt is happening and when blame is. And some of the things I spoke about earlier about some of those defensive ways we react to shame versus other choices or patterns. In session three of the shame-informed groups, we'd be looking at schemas and behavior patterns. Usually, again, these are things over years, over time that have been reinforced. So it's going to take time and practice to overcome them. So we'll be teaching how to use the CBT cognitive debating skills and testing out justifications for erroneous beliefs. Over sessions 4 through 9, there'd be processing of specific traumatic events. So we'd be incorporating narrative therapy, not just what happens, but what do we do from here? And then the group context providing support for that. Session 10 would focus on values. So something along the lines of the acceptance and commitment therapy. What are my values in life? How do I communicate these? What behaviors do I do in addition to my words to show what the values are to me? And then session 11, looking at realistic goals. And session 12, summary and termination. Processing of emotions is always going to be a real core thing with any of our work regarding trauma. Emotions, and this is from a article I cited, which you can see on the PowerPoint, the reference there. There's a quote, "Emotions signify movement or shifting within a person's being and should be understood as a signal or motivation to bring about a change in circumstance. We want to share with parents that emotions trigger physiological changes. It's not possible to just stop an emotion. It needs to run its course. Or, here's the key, or be transformed by another emotion. By focusing on the emotion and its need instead of the correctness of an emotion, we can help emotions be successfully processed. We cannot argue with emotions. Emotions are always value. So one of the biggest things we can do that's most empowering to a client is helping to give their vulnerability a voice. I actually give them this formula. They fill in the blank, and we kind of do it together because it's really hard, again, if they have not told the narrative or not had a voice, it's hard for them to practice this. So we really kind of come up with this together. So I feel blank. Fill in the blank with an emotion word or two. When or because blank. So their description of the circumstance. The thing I most need when this happens is blank. So we're talking about a concrete behavioral action. Or else if I don't get that, I'm afraid I will blank. That's important because that identifies that vulnerability. Oh, if I don't get what I need, am I going to scream, yell, cuss, end a relationship? Am I going to be self-destructive? Am I going to become codependent? Next part. In the future, what would help me is blank. Would you be willing to blank? So basically, this person sharing their feelings, the situation as they see it, their fears, and their need. And then they're asking with a kind, soft lead-in, would you be willing to? So they're asking for help.